May we be reminded here now of our highest aspirations and inspired to bring our gifts of love and service to the altar of humanity. May we know that we are not isolated beings, but connected in mystery and miracle to the universe, to this community, and to each other. Let's sing.
My name is Hillary Hutchinson, and many of you know that I've been a member of this church for a very long time, since June of 1987, to be exact. Today's sermon topic is Beyond Tolerance. Tolerance is a word that I feel is used entirely too loosely by Unitarian Universalists. What does it really mean to tolerate something? Are we pronouncing our acceptance of differing views? Or are we merely putting up with difficult, irritating, unpleasant people and situations until we can get away from them? As in something we've all recently experienced, I'll just have to tolerate these weather-related traffic delays since I can't do anything about them. On a personal level, what do we tolerate in ourselves? Are we willing to really look hard at our own dark sides, the part of us that is racist, because it is in fact a natural human reaction to people who are different from ourselves? Can we look at ourselves directly and acknowledge our own capacity to commit evil? In one episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, as she prepares to kill one of her mortal enemies, he stops her cold by asking, "Does not your power come from the dark side? Without vampires, there would be no need of vampire slayers." The vamp has a point, I think. Fear and anger provide tremendous assistance for survival. All these parts, good and bad, coexist in us and need to be balanced. The psychoanalyst Robert Johnson refers to this dilemma as needing to own the shadow side. Johnson's simple definition of the dark side is socially unacceptable feelings and/or behaviors. In my own case, I have a tremendous fear of failure. The message tape that plays in my brain is, you are not good enough. You will never be good enough. I can trace this message back at least four generations in my family to a fire and brimstone Baptist preacher forebear whose given name, ironically, was Reasoner. By returning to school to pursue a PhD, I am challenging myself in a way that I never have before, and I'm terribly afraid I will be found wanting. And if I do not do something to acknowledge this fear and integrate it into my life, there can be some nasty consequences. For instance, if someone at school criticizes what I've done and I bite back any response, I might just go to the grocery store and be unabashedly rude to the checkout clerk, to them for no apparent reason. I want to suggest that worship, which Davidson has told us comes from the Old English word, means worth shaping and can be a path for integrating our shadow side. Dr. Johnson suggests small ritualized behaviors to get rid of the shadow, like writing down some personal bad behavior and burning it. Lighting our candles of hope and memory can be a personal rite of purification. At least that's what I use it for. Lighting and then extinguishing the chalice provides a frame for the dark and the light within the context of our services. We can also use the Sunday morning sermons to shape our character, giving voice to anger, resentments, fear, and frustrations with the world in a manner that increases our compassion instead of diminishing it. By going beyond mere acknowledgement to actual integration of our dark side, we can expand and extend our compassion for others and ourselves. The conscious creation of a whole or healed character can be a strategy allowing the play of dark in our life, but within rational and relational boundaries. We can choose our reactions, if not exactly what happens. Or as my own grandmother would say, it's not the cards you're dealt, it's how you play them. So here I am, at 47 years of age, telling you once again, we are all in this game of being human together. And I'm still trying to learn how to play the cards that I've been dealt. We all have our own shadow and our own light. And that, at least, is very comforting.
time in the service where we light candles, if we wish, to mark prayers, hopes, dreams. So if you would like to light a candle, or if you just want to remain sitting, remembering why you're here, please do so now. And now, will you hear the cry of the psalmist? She might use words like God and Lord, but she's calling out to the source of all creation and all that is. O Lord, you have searched me and known me. You know when I sit down and when I rise up. You discern my thoughts from far away. You search out my path and my lying down. Even before a word is on my tongue, O Lord, you know it completely. You hem me in behind and before and lay your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is so high that I cannot attain it. Where can I go from your spirit? Or where can I flee from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in hell, you are there. If I take the wings of the morning and settle at the farthest limits of the sea, even there your hand shall lead me, and your right hand shall hold me fast. For it was you who formed my inward parts. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works that I know very well. Oh, that you would kill the wicked, O God, and that the bloodthirsty would depart from me. Those who speak of you maliciously and lift themselves up against you for evil, do I not hate those who hate you, O Lord? And do I not loathe those who rise up against you? I hate them with perfect hatred. I count them my enemies. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Test me and know my thoughts. See if there is any wicked way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. Well, before I begin to offer you this sermon, I just want to remind you, you're a teaching congregation. I'm very confident that I've tried hard. What are the parts of us that we would rather not see? The lazy parts, the selfish parts, the sad parts, the angry parts, the defeated parts, the weak parts. You okay? The fearful, the needy, the hurt parts. They are there, but we try hard, don't we, to hide them away so that they won't bother anyone too much. I bet we could all do a little inventory and identify those antisocial and uncivilized parts as well as our natural resistance to go there. Or maybe we have lost sight of our own capacities to be wild or undependable or unpredictable or violent or vindictive or doubtful, or maybe we could even deny that we are anything but well-intentioned. We might not go as far as to say we are pure goodness, but haven't we convinced ourselves of the saintliness of someone who has loved us well? It is comforting to dwell on our capacities for giving, for being enthusiastic and positive, and seeing the best in others. But does this tendency serve any purpose beyond ourselves? If others know how lazy, angry, sullen, or despondent we can be, they might not want to be our workmates or live with us or even be our friends. So we do our best to contain these difficult or ugly aspects of our being. We put them in the closet and hide them in the shadows. It is a common human experience. We all do this, and we do it to get along and function the best way we can as members of families, religious communities, as members of staffs or teams or professions, as members and citizens of our society. This morning I want to speak to these dark sides of our being and give a crack to the closet door, cracking it open to see what happens if we go ahead and look at the parts of us we would rather not see or have lost sight of altogether. Because we might discover that it's not only the foibles of our characters that have got shoved into the shadows over the years, but some great parts too, which were hidden just because they were inconvenient or unwanted or threatening to others. The wholeness of our weird and wonderful beings is something we come into the world with and which we spend a good portion of our life carving up to suit our life circumstances, only to slowly reclaim these parts as we are able and as the demands of this life ebb and free us from the constraints which we have allowed to define us. It is the older and wiser among us who have the most insight to this process, and they are the ones who are the most likely to offer us the paradox that exists in being human, the ones who have learned that there is a time to speak and a time to remain silent, that it is good and right to have goals and dreams to strive for, and that it is also good and right to sacrifice those same goals and dreams and to let them go. When Hillary suggested the topic of owning your own shadow in the Worship Associates meeting way back in September, I was unfamiliar with the little book she was making reference to by Robert A. Johnson. He wrote the book in 1991 with the full title, Owning Your Own Shadow, Understanding the Dark Side of the Psyche. He is a great synthetic thinker who combines sociology and comparative religion in his psychological interpretations of the human condition. How many of you have read his work? Not too many. He is a Jungian analyst, and he works with the notion that we all operate from both conscious and subconscious impulses, and that all human beings are co-inheritors of the collective unconscious, the deeply embedded symbols which speak to the basic human condition. Hillary wanted to share his basic message that we can maintain better control of our natural human tendencies towards violence, aggression, and bigotry by acknowledging the wholeness of our individual natures, including all the nasty qualities we've tried to disown, and giving them symbolic expression through religious ritual. I was drawn to the topic because I have come to believe that evil, or the human capacity to do harm to others or ourselves, is inherent, as natural to our being as the capacity to nurture and love. And I hope there would be something to be gained by our recognition of this potential in ourselves, if I could persuade you of its truth, whether it be a greater vigilance in the way we examine our motives, or a greater awareness of the import of every decision we make in the way we lead our lives. It seemed to me, and it still does, that we are less likely to fear evil if we can recognize it as something so close at hand. We would be less likely to see it as the fault of another if we could see it as a possibility for ourselves. After reading Johnson's book, this belief was partly affirmed. Let me briefly outline the progression of this book. First, he says that the process of disowning those parts of ourselves is natural. A baby learns not to bite. A child learns slowly to control her temper. In school, a child must learn to rein in his energy and sit still. And exuberant free play gets shaped into focused attention as the skills and rules of sports are acquired. The capacity of the child to bite, to lose her temper, to play wildly are all still there, but they are contained. Later in life, the socially acceptable ways of behaving as a lady or a gentleman are adopted as the young person strives towards recognition as an adult. And then the demands and the constraints of a job identify which character traits are to be given fuller expression. It is much more important, for instance, to be reliable than spontaneous. It is much more desirable to be careful and competent than daring and experimental. As with the child, the underlying nature of the person remains intact and complete. It's just that we have abandoned some of our qualities in favor of others in order to participate in our culture. Johnson calls it an inexorable truth, a law that all aspects of the individual's character endure. It is just a matter of cultivating the qualities which help us function in our world and hiding the ones which don't. Johnson then identifies the problems that can creep up. For instance, if we try to ignore the shadowy parts of ourselves and pretend that they do not exist, we will resent being reminded of them and might well despise the same qualities in others, projecting onto others aspects of our own unwanted being. Johnson says that this can happen collectively, and whole societies can be similarly driven by such subconscious rejection of their disowned qualities. We must believe we are freedom-loving and dedicated to the ideals of democracy, as we have heard repeatedly this week, so we condemn or attack societies that we may accuse of tyranny, and feel it is somehow righteous even to impose our chosen form of governance on them. We must believe we are peaceful and peace-loving, and we fail to recognize the expression of our own rejected nature in the constant stream. Let me try that again. We must believe we are peaceful and peace-loving at the same time as we fail to recognize the expression of our own rejected nature in the constant stream of horror films, violent television shows, and digital war games that allow you to shoot firsthand. Can we continue to accept the lie that fighting wars is necessary to achieve the peace we all love so well? What would happen if the skeleton in our nation's closet was to be revealed? Maybe the aggression and the will to dominate could energize the rebuilding of this society. Finally, Johnson points to the healing mechanism of religious ritual to reunify the different parts of ourselves and restore a wholeness to our being. It can do that, he says, by giving symbolic representation to the darker aspects of life in a context which allows for both the expression and the containment of the destructive as well as the constructive forces of existence. Johnson talks about the gory imagery of the Christian Mass or communion ritual. Participants celebrate in the eating of their Savior's flesh and the drinking of his blood. The image of the tortured man hanging on the cross is glorified as the means of salvation. The paradox of a persecuted dying man having the power to save all who would confess his name contains healing by joining two very divergent understandings of the way things are and bringing them together. Johnson says that any mechanism that does this bringing together of separate and divergent forces, can heal. He says the joining of two people, whether in a glance or in sexual union, can also be as healing. Christianity is not the only religion that incorporates aspects of destruction to serve the purpose of integrating the dark parts of our human nature. In Hinduism's main godhead, Shiva is understood to be the god of destruction, to counterbalance Brahma, the god of creation, and Vishnu, the god of preservation. In this arrangement, there is a full acknowledgement of the dynamic nature of existence. There are creative, sustaining, and destructive forces, and they are each honored and recognized. And all the worshippers can then acknowledge such divergent forces in their own being. This is one of the reasons I have valued the Hindu goddess Kali. She is a truly frightening warrior goddess, depicted with severed human arms strung around her waist and severed human heads hanging from her neck. She holds a bloody knife and she wags a long, obnoxious tongue at everyone. She is worshipped as a mother, loved and supplicated by her devotees. They expect her to be as giving and loyal to them as they are to her, though they know she can be dangerous. Now, that is a depiction of integration, loving mother and wild woman. She lets me be me. Kali does not give license to her devotees to follow her example, but she does offer them a paradox, which they can use to try to find a balance between the disparate qualities of light and dark they experience in life and in themselves. We need to be encouraged towards integration and wholeness. As religious liberals, we need to bring together the parts of our being which we may have lost connection with. But we don't take communion, and we don't go to confession. But confession is probably closer to our religious tendencies than worshiping gods and goddesses. And this is where we return to the therapeutic effects of talking. Not so much in dialogue with another, but out loud with the sense that we are being heard. With talking it out honestly, we can come to a place of greater self-understanding and hope to reclaim those parts of ourselves that have been too wretched, too depressed, enraged, or frightening to own up to. We do not need a priest to mediate this confession, but we do need a safe and contained place to begin to sort out the wholeness of our being. And we can find priests and teachers helpful too. There is a story told by Rachel Naomi Raymond, the first writer that Davidson pointed me towards when I first started speaking with him, about it is her story about the power of her grandfather's blessings. When she was a little girl, she went to have tea with her Orthodox Jewish rabbi grandfather every week on Friday afternoons. These are her words now. After we had finished our tea, my grandfather would set two candles on the table and light them. Then he would have a word with God in Hebrew. Sometimes he would speak out loud, but often he would just close his eyes and be quiet. I knew then that he was talking to God in his heart. I would sit and wait patiently because the best part of the week was coming. When Grandpa finished talking to God, he would turn towards me and say, "Come." Then I would stand in front of him, and he would rest his hands lightly on the top of my head. He would begin by thanking God for me and for making him my grandpa. He would specifically mention my struggles during that week and tell God something about me that was true. Each week I would wait to find out what it was. We want to know the fullness of our being. If I had made mistakes during the week, he would mention my honesty in telling the truth. If I had failed, he would appreciate how hard I had tried. These few moments were the only time in my week when I felt completely safe and at rest. That's the end of her words. I love how well this story expresses the power of acknowledging our weaknesses and connecting them to our struggles to be good. It is healing to be known in the fullness of our being and deeply reassuring to realize that the wholeness can encompass our foibles without leaving us beyond the hope of another's love and care. We Unitarian Universalists do not enter so fully into the language of ritual. We come together to worship and we light a chalice, as Hilary has mentioned. And the flame does reveal both the power of light and the power of transformative forces like fire, but it does not speak powerfully to the dark in our lives. And I think we might need more to help us come to terms with the darkness in our world and in ourselves. Perhaps there is a symbol which could speak to the paradox of the different and opposing parts of our nature. I am sure many of you are familiar with this symbol from ancient Chinese philosophy. This is the symbol of yin and yang. Who knows it already? Oh, wow, a lot. Okay, well, I'll still go ahead. Here it is. The circle, I did it anyway to begin with, so... The circle represents the whole of existence, the cosmos. Within the cosmos, there is a duality that can be seen in all the forces of nature. This duality is represented by the equal sections of black and white. These forces are opposite in nature, but contain within themselves the seeds of the other. As represented by the two dots. There is a dynamic quality to these dual forces. They both seem to be moving into each other, and this is a representation of the constancy of change in our world. In this symbol, there is an acknowledgement of the profound relatedness of all apparent opposites. It suggests that integration is the nature of all things, and there is less need to draw together the good and bad, the active and passive, the creative and the destructive, and more need to become aware of how all these qualities of being find their complete expression through their relationship to the opposite and to the whole. I want to finish this morning with another story from Rachel Naomi Raymond. This one is about an emergency room physician named Harry and how he was surprised into recognizing a greater wholeness to his own being. Like all medical and other professionals, Harry was trained to be competent and expert and was used to putting his emotions in the shadows where they could not reveal his hopes, fears, and vulnerabilities to his patients. One night, he was on shift, and a woman in the emergency department, and a woman was brought in by ambulance, a very pregnant, about-to-give-birth woman. He examined her and called her OBGYN, but it was just a courtesy call. He knew it was likely too late and that he'd be delivering the baby. So the woman's husband was brought into the emergency room, and the nurses quickly prepared for the birth. The doctor was pleased as he liked delivering babies. And this baby came very quickly and with no complications at all. Harry was then holding the newborn along his arm with her little head in his hand. And as he was using a suction bulb to remove the mucus from her mouth and nose, when suddenly the little girl opened her eyes and looked right into his own eyes. Harry had a moment of discovery. He realized that he was the first human being that this little girl had ever seen. He felt his heart go out to her in welcome from all people everywhere, and tears came to his eyes. Later, as he reflected on this, he realized that although he had delivered hundreds of babies in his career, he had never let himself experience the meaning of what he was doing until that one birth. In a sense, he felt that that was the first baby he had really delivered as both a physician and as a human being. I want to leave you with a reassurance that life can surprise us, as it shows in this story, with unanticipated opportunities to grow into fuller expression of our own being, and that far from endangering those around us with the possibility of our shadow sides, we can reveal more powerfully the depths and truths of our shared humanity. We need to be careful and intentional, for in inviting the shadow parts into the light of day, we are playing with fire. But we can also trust, and we can also trust ourselves. And to the degree that we dare to bring the wholeness of our being into the circle of light, into the company we keep, and into the consciousness with which we make our choices, to that degree we can hope to make a difference. Embodying the paradox that light and dark coexist in us and in all around us, and demonstrating the power of the human capacity for honesty. As religious liberals, we mostly reject the idea that humans inherit original sin. But can we deny that evil is inherent to our being? Let us commit ourselves to living up to our assertion of the worth and dignity of every person, with an understanding that it is by the decisions we make that we are ennobled or debased. We are all like the child asking how to be a good person. We want to be a good person, but we don't always know the best way to do that. But like the story said, if we can remember that the most important moment is now, and the most important person is the one we are with, and the most important thing to do is whatever we can for the one by our side, then we will be all right, regardless of the shadows and despite the dark.